Well, howdy there, stranger. I'm Jordy.
And I'm Brad.
And welcome back to Beers with Queers, the true crime podcast where I research a case, and Brad here, and potentially you guys,
don't know a damn thing about it.
So to start things off, me and Brad both are feeling extremely under the weather at the time of recording this. So if we sound a little stopped up or lagging or lethargic, that's why, because we have been laid up in our houses for several days at this point.
I have been sick for about 5 days now, and I mean extremely sick. I'm a baby when I'm sick, but I mean, I am at the point where it's like I could not get out of bed for 2 days.
So we thought about postponing this episode, but then that would seem really unfair to you guys, considering the fact that this is part two of a two-part episode, and so we kind of left you on a cliffhanger at the end of last week, and so we really don't want to make you guys wait longer than you have to, and so we're going to power through it. We're going to do our best, so it is that time of the year. A lot of people are getting sick. Sadly, we just happened to catch it. If you're sick, hopefully you get better. If you're not sick, hopefully you don't get sick, and pray that we make a speedy recovery.
And if you are ever going to share an episode, share this one, because this one is made specifically out of love and devotion to you guys. Otherwise, I would be in my bed asleep right now.
So yes, this is the one thing that got Brad out of bed and also me, is to bring the finale of this case to you guys. And so we're excited to finish it off with you guys. So, like I said, this is part two in the final episode of our coverage of the infamous crime duo Leopold and Loeb. We're going to do a rundown of everything we covered in part one, but for a more detailed and descriptive version of events, highly recommend you pause this episode and listen to part one first if you haven't already. So, Nathan Leopold and Richard Loeb were two teenagers in 1920 Chicago who had every possible advantage in life. They were from extremely wealthy families and never had to want for anything, and both were naturally extremely intelligent in school. Both had genius IQs, and this high intelligence gave them a, superiority complex over their fellow classmates.
They were douchebags.
They were major douchebags, and because, it's a combination of they're extremely wealthy and they were genuinely really smart, it kind of gave them that attitude that they were gods amongst mortals. So the two knew each other their entire lives as they grew up in the same affluent neighborhood of Chicago, but didn't really become friends until they reunited in college. Now, this friendship eventually turned into a secret love affair between the two, and pretty soon that turned into the two committing crimes together to try and prove their ideology that they were, in fact, quote-unquote, supermen. Now, supermen being a term that the two boys obsessed over, which stated that humans with higher intelligence are above the law, and they can do whatever they want and get away with it no matter what, because they're just that much smarter than everyone.
Spoiler, they're not.
No, otherwise we wouldn't be talking about this case to this day 100 years later. So the two decided to put this to the test by planning and executing the perfect crime. The crime they settled on being the ransom and murder of a child from an affluent family. After spending nearly 6 months planning out their crime and making sure everything was in place to where they wouldn't get caught, the two finally acted on the plan on May 21st, 1924, and abducted, murdered, and mutilated 14-year-old Bobby Franks, who also just so happened to be Richard Loeb's cousin.
And they abducted him just like a block from his house, which he lived directly across from the victim.
So that shows you how smart they actually were. So after dumping the body in a secluded area, the two began to taunt the Franks family with calls demanding a ransom for Bobby's safe return. Now, this part of the plan failed, however, when Bobby's body was discovered the day after the murder, much sooner than the two had anticipated. But, even though they didn't get the ransom money, they were confident that they had gotten away with the quote-unquote perfect murder, and they were sure that police would never be able to trace it back to them. Nathan Leopold had accidentally dropped his glasses out of his coat pocket when dumping Bobby's body, and police now have them in their possession, but they aren't sure what to make of them just yet, as a full investigation is open to hunt down Bobby's killer or killers, as the entire city of Chicago descends into chaos. So that is a brief summary of part one, and is where we left you at the end of that episode. The city of Chicago is terrified, police are throwing everything and everyone they have at this investigation, and Leopold and Loeb are just kicking back, reaping the fruits of their labor, because this is exactly what they wanted. Completely unaware that police already have everything they needed to find them. So even though police had a mysterious pair of eyeglasses in their possession, they didn't really know how to use them or use them to find the killer at first. So they started investigating with the information that they had on hand. They started with the name on the ransom letter, George Johnson, and they began by interviewing everyone in the city of Chicago that had either the name George or the last name Johnson. And this is just a strange detail, but somehow, and we don't know how to this day, they even put out a composite sketch of what George Johnson supposedly looked like, even though it looks nothing like Leopold and Loeb, and George Johnson is not a real person, so how they came up with that is anyone's guess. Now, after this turned up nothing, an eyewitness actually came forward, a school friend of Bobby's, actually stated that he saw a gray Winton car speed away from the baseball game not long after Bobby left. Following this lead, everyone who owned a gray Winton was brought in for questioning and interrogated. After this too failed to turn up any viable leads, they next turned their attention to the staff at the school. So, since a ransom was asked as part of the original plan, it was thought that maybe a disgruntled teacher at the school had decided to kidnap Bobby. Because although the students were wealthy, the teachers at the school barely made minimum wage, which is still a problem to this day, you know, like, pay your teachers. They literally are bringing up the next generation of kids, so. Now, the male teachers were looked at extra hard as well, because since Bobby was found naked, it was speculated by police that a male may have abducted him to sexually abuse him. So, this is the first defined group of suspects police had, and every teacher at the school was brought in for official interrogation. Now, this is the 1920s, and let's just say that interrogation procedures were very different than they are today, generally speaking, because these interrogations weren't just, you know, bringing you in and asking you a bunch of personal questions and officers trying to catch you in a lie type of stuff. These were the type where police would actively beat and torture you to get you to confess to whatever they wanted to hear. Multiple teachers and other suspects were subjected to hours upon hours across several days in a row of grueling beatings with a rubber garden hose by officers in hopes of getting them to confess.
Could you imagine just being like your average teacher and getting brought in for questioning and getting beaten for days?
With a garden hose, out of all things, you know that's gotta hurt. And these poor teachers, like I said, they're barely making minimum wage and now they're getting beaten by police. And the beatings were so severe that some were left with serious injuries and actually required to go to the hospital for medical attention. But now, even after all of them were cleared as suspects, a lot of them faced backlash from the public for being questioned in connection with the case, and that made them have to quit their jobs at the school and flee the city. So even though they were completely innocent, it's like, you were questioned, so obviously you must be a shady character if police believe you to be responsible.
And you got a beating for free.
And you got a free beating to boot. So that shows you just how hysterical Chicago really was at this point. People were going crazy looking for answers to who killed Bobby. And of course, this was probably a bigger reaction than normal because Bobby is from one of the wealthiest families in the city. And so there's a lot more effort to find who did it because as we'll see later on, there was a lot of murders actually around this time period that police were just kind of like, eh. So after the teachers were excluded, police then went about working with the local game warden of the nature preserve where Bobby's body was found in order to get a list of people who frequented the area. And on that list was Nathan Leopold. So he was actually brought in for questioning on May 24th, and Nathan admitted to being in the area, often to bird hunt, but of course stated he knew nothing of Bobby's murder, and police believed him right away due to his high stature in society. And so they were like, this is just a formality, we gotta clear you, and he's just like, no, I didn't do it. And so he was not subjected to a garden hose.
But it also goes to show, when they're planning this perfect crime, they dump the body in a place that he's known to often visit. Again, this just doesn't sound like they planned the perfect crime to me.
No, they were complete idiots. So they decided to let him go, but not before asking him if he wore glasses, to which he replied no. So again, they knew the glasses probably belonged to the killer, but honestly at this point, there's no way to tell. So by the time of his questioning was over, Leopold was now fully aware that he had lost his glasses at the pond and police had them in their custody. He talked it over with Loeb and he put forth the idea that maybe he should come forward and claim them now, claiming that he must have dropped them out there while he was on one of his previous bird hunting trips. However, Loeb talked him out of this idea and assured him that there was no way for police to ever trace them back to Leopold, so the couple continued to relax and watch the chaos they caused unfold. But their time would finally come on Thursday, May 29th. So normally their assumption that the glasses couldn't be traced back to them would be correct. However, upon closer examination, it turned out that the glasses were made with a very specific brand of hinge from a company that catered to affluent clients and was made exclusively in New York and sold through contracted stores in other cities. So investigators contact the hinge manufacturer and they ask them to search through the record for any glasses sold in the Chicago area. Now, luckily, as it turned out, that the brand only had one licensed seller in Chicago, and that seller was able to tell investigators that they only sold 3 sets of those hinges. Right away, 2 of the owners were able to be eliminated due to being out of the country at the time, and that left only one person, Nathan Leopold. So armed with this new piece of information, investigators set out to interview Leopold for a second time. So at first, investigators actually still weren't suspicious of Leopold, and they figured he must have some sort of explanation. So they brought him back to the station and asked him, you know, what's your glasses doing at the scene of a murder? And at first he tried to brush it off and stated those weren't his glasses and his pair were at home. So of course, investigators like, okay, can you take us back to your place and show us where the glasses are? So he said, sure. And then he took them back to his house and spent over an hour looking for the glasses before stating, you know what? I must have misplaced them. So then after that story failed, he went with the story that he told Loeb before, that he must have dropped them out of his pocket when he was bird hunting there a few weeks back. So again, investigators actually had him put his coat on and place the glasses in the pocket, and they had him do all sorts of weird moves and motions, and with each one, his glasses remained firmly in his jacket. So now this is the point where they're starting to get suspicious, because he is 2 for 2 and being caught in a lie. Now Leopold's story changed again when he stated that on the night of the murder, he and Loeb have taken Leopold's car and driven around Chicago after picking up 2 girls at a local bar, and the foursome drank gin most of the night before departing and going home. However, this story also fell apart when investigators searched Leopold's room and discovered a note he had written to Loeb, dated October 23, 1923, in which it seems the 2 were having some sort of falling out, and Leopold was angry that Loeb was trying to break off the relationship. So an excerpt from that letter actually reads, and I'll let Brad read this.
Now, a word of advice. I do not wish to influence your decision either way, but I do want to warn you that if you deem it advisable to end our friendship, that is, in both of our best interests, that extreme care must be had. A falling out between a pair of cocksuckers would surely be a popular motif to everyone that creates an irksome but unavoidable bond between us.
So Leopold, of course, was threatening to out both of them as gay if Loeb tried to cut off contact. And this was also obvious to investigators who now knew the pair were at least in a homosexual relationship. And thus, their story of spending the evening with 2 women didn't make much sense. And on top of that, they now wanted to talk with Richard Loeb. Now, both boys were taken down to Chicago Criminal Court building and questioned throughout the entire night and until dawn the next day. But both continued to deny any involvement in the murder, and unlike the previous suspects, both were treated with the utmost respect and were even put up in a hotel for the night. So that just goes to show you too, like, how people are treated based on how wealthy they are. They literally thought, well, you're a teacher, you might be broke and want money, so we're going to beat you with a garden hose. But then someone who literally has been caught in 3 lies about their alibi and a piece of their clothing, like their glasses, was found at the scene of the murder, and police are still like, hey, you know what, we're just going to treat you nice, just stay in this hotel, you know, sleep it off, maybe we'll remember something in the morning. And at this point, police actually still had their doubts that the 2 were responsible, as it just seemed odd that men of their stature would commit such a heinous crime. So their questioning was kept hush from reporters, and their families were notified to discuss how to go about the situation. The families of both men agreed to fully cooperate with investigators and allowed for all their belongings to be searched, and with this, Leopold and Loeb families unknowingly sealed the boys' fate as the investigators now set out to interview everyone at the mansions that day, and it would lead to their stories unraveling. So on May 20th, the Leopold family's chauffeur, a man named Sven England, was brought in for an interview, and he told investigators that he was actually working on Leopold's car the entire evening of May 24th during the murder, and that even after he left for a few hours and returned around 9 p.m., the car was exactly where he had left it. With this information, investigators now knew that Leopold and Loeb's whole alibi was fake, and it was time to turn up the heat. So, which of the 2 do you think cracked first?
I think it would be Leopold.
So almost immediately after being confronted by police, then they knew their story was bullshit. Loeb spilled his entire guts to them and told them the whole story about how he and Leopold wanted to commit the perfect murder and all the planning they had done and everything they did to murder Bobby. Now, of course, he painted Leopold as being the mastermind behind the whole thing and the one who actually murdered Bobby. So, of course, armed with this info, police went to Leopold, and upon learning the jig was up, he too spilled his guts and told the exact same story as Loeb, save for the fact that he stated Loeb was the mastermind behind the whole thing, and he was the one who actually murdered Bobby. So in just a little over a week, 10 days to be exact, these two dipshits' whole plan unraveled, and it didn't even take them that much effort to get them to confess. So, you know, it's like, what happened to being supermen? What happened to be so more intellectually superior to everyone? Because they literally were confronted with one, like, hey, we think your story's BS. And they immediately were like, okay, you're right. It's true. This is everything we did, down to the last detail. So with these confessions, Nathan Leopold and Richard Loeb were officially arrested for the murder of Bobby Franks on May 31st. Even after the two confessed in great detail, the lead investigator on the case knew that this was going to be a pretty bizarre story and motive to present to the press. And he was worried that considering the boys' high society status and their family's reputations, that the public may believe that their confessions were coerced or threatened out of them. And thus, he made both boys swear that they were treated fairly and decently in front of an entire room of people. So by the evening of May 31st, their arrests were announced on the front page of every paper in the city. So following their arrest, police took the two men out to the scene where they dumped the body, and both boys relished in their newfound infamy and were even smiling and cracking jokes as they described how they poured acid over Bobby's face to try and melt it. Leopold actually also gave a reporter a statement in which he said, "It was just an experiment for us, like an entomologist sticking a pin through a beetle." So at this point, neither man was feigning innocence for what they did and fully embraced the shock and horror that they had caused. So not only with their two confessions and their behavior in front of the press, prosecutors were extremely happy that not only did they solve the biggest scandal in Chicago history up to that point, but that it was a sure-to-be slam dunk at trial and that they were positive both men would hang. But, you know, that was going to be easier said than done once Leopold and Loeb's families learned that prosecutors were going for the death penalty and both used their combined wealth to hire the best lawyer they could find in the form of Clarence Darrow, a very respected and notorious defense attorney. Not only did they hire the best lawyers, but also the best doctors and psychiatrists and every other professional they could potentially save their sons from death. In total, the two spent over $15 million on this trial, which today would amount to almost $250 million. So, of course, this did not go over well with the public, who were enraged that it seemed that only the wealthy were given the best of the best and that it could not possibly be a fair trial. Since the boys' family had so much pull in the city, people also weren't happy with Clarence Darrow, as up to that point, he had made a name for himself by representing poor and lower middle class clients who otherwise wouldn't have access to decent counsel. However, Darrow was quick to tell everyone that he was not taking on this case due to the money, but because he was a very staunch supporter against the death penalty, and he knew that Leopold and Loeb would almost certainly hang without a good lawyer there to help.
I'm wondering how, you know, this was one of them's cousin. I wonder how he feels about that. You know, it's like the family comes together to, like, save these two, but, like, you also killed part of the family.
And melted his faces, and melted his face with acid. And you're still callous about it now in the media, talking about how it's just an experiment for you and stuff like that. So, obviously, like, they are not sorry at all. So what was already going to be a huge trial to begin with quickly exploded to become what we describe now as a trial of the century and would be the talk of everyone in America. So the lead prosecutor on the case, a man named Rick Crowe, was already prepared to throw the best of the best at Leopold and Loeb in terms of experts to testify against the couple's guilt and state of mind, figuring that both boys' defense would rely solely on not guilty by reason of insanity. He sprung for the best psychiatrist and medical expert from all over the country to be flown into Chicago, and in turn, Darrow did the same. Now, Crowe was extremely eager to get an airtight conviction of these two, as he was up for mayor, actually, and the election would begin not long after the trial, and he knew that if he was able to convict the two, he was locked and loaded to win the election. But of course, now Darrow, backed by two of the wealthiest families in the city and giving every resources he wanted to save Leopold and Loeb's lives, it was going to be a difficult battle from both sides. So on top of this, we have to remember that America was going through a huge cultural change at this time. You know, this was smack dab in the Roaring Twenties or the Jazz Age, and so the entire social culture of the States was being one of self-indulgence, sexual freedom, and a disregard for what many old-timers at the time described as quote-unquote decent morality. And the murder of Bobby Franks by two men who represented all of these new quote-unquote Jazz Age ideologies became a hot topic across the country amongst those who opposed to this new way of life, and thus the case began getting used as a cautionary tale as to why this new found freedom was bad for America, which of course in turn sparked huge debates across both sides of the argument and launched Leopold and Loeb into national fame. So before the trial even began, first thing both sides of the case had to do was prove if Leopold and Loeb were of sound mind and sane at the time of Bobby Frank's murder. So from June 13th to June 30th, the two men were examined by a whole slew of psychologists from both the prosecutor and their defense, which included Drs. Healy, Holbert, Bowman, and Gluck, with all of them examining the entire history of the boys' lives, literally talking from the time their mothers found out they were pregnant with them all the way up until the day of the murder. Now, this was crucial to establish their sanity, as Darrow knew he had an almost impossible to win case on his hands, since both confessed in detail, showed investigators where key pieces of evidence were, and gave statements to reporters about how they weren't sorry for what they did. So their only real hope out of the death penalty was to be declared unfit to stand trial. Now, one very, very strange detail I came across, and one that's very underreported about these mental evaluations, is that during them, Leopold and Loeb actually confessed several other crimes, including at least two other murders and one attempted murder. So in November of 1923, a man named Charles Ream was walking home late at night when he was approached by two young men who stuck a revolver in his face and demanded his money. Afterwards, he was knocked unconscious and beaten, and he woke up several hours later in a ditch to find that he was covered in blood and soon realized that he had actually been castrated. Now, after Leopold and Loeb were arrested for the murder of Bobby and their pictures were put into the papers, Charles would actually come forward to police and state that he was sure beyond a shadow of a doubt that they were the two men that attacked him. 5 days after Charles was castrated, a 23-year-old student from the University of Chicago named Freeman Tracy was found shot several times through the head after walking home alone at night. Now, the bullets that were used to kill Freeman were found to have been a match to the type of gun that Leopold kept in his room. Finally, in April of 1924, a man named Melvin Wolfe would disappear and be found dead from a gunshot wound just a week later. Melvin actually disappeared from the same area as Bobby Franks would just a month later. So, even though there was decent, honestly, circumstantial evidence in these cases, because you have an eyewitness claiming, like, these are the two men that attacked me, Crow actually felt that it would confuse the jury and derail the current investigation into Bobby's murder, and so he chose not to investigate the leads any further, and this would actually be one of the last times this is brought up. So to this day, all these crimes remain officially unsolved, and we will never know if Leopold and Loeb were actually involved, and if they weren't, then why did they admit to them? So that's one thing too. A lot of modern day researchers believe that more than likely they weren't involved with these murders just because they were so open and in detail about Bobby's murder, but they just kind of admitted to these. But again, it's kind of weird that there was an eyewitness to it, and it was the same type of gun that was used to kill the victims, was found in Leopold's room. And so it's just one of those things where it's kind of like a forgotten piece of history that'll make you think a little. So by the end of the examinations, it was officially determined that both men were more than sane at the time of the murder, and they were fit to stand trial. So the trial for both boys was set to begin on July 21st, 1924, and at this point, all hope seemed lost for their families at avoiding the death penalty. There seemed to be nothing else that they could be done to save them at this point. Crow had an airtight case, and even if he didn't, the story of what Leopold and Loeb had done had spread all over the country, and they were the most hated men alive at this point. There was not going to be any way to find an impartial jury, and so it didn't matter. Even if Crow didn't have a case, the jury was going to find them guilty. But Darrow had one last trick up his sleeve. So on the morning of July 21st, both sides gathered in a courtroom before a judge to enter a plea for Leopold and Loeb. When asked what that plea was, Darrow stood up and stated, "Your Honor, we would like to withdraw our not guilty plea," and instead they plead guilty to all charges of first-degree murder and kidnapping. So now this is it.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
A massive shockwave throughout the entire courtroom and completely blindsided Crow and the judge overseeing the case, Judge Caverly. So Crow had suspected that Darrow may change the boy's plea to guilty by reason of insanity, but not simply guilty on all charges. Now, after asking several times that they were sure this was the plea they were going to go with, the judge accepted it and set the sentencing date for the crime to begin on July 23rd. So at first, everyone thought that Darrow was crazy, but pretty soon, they learned that there was a method to his madness. Darrow understood that if they had pled not guilty and moved forward with a trial, it didn't matter how much he tried or how hard he tried, a jury was going to sentence Leopold and Loeb to hang.
Plus, during that trial, more and more stuff would come out and make him look even worse and worse, I'm sure.
So by going ahead and pleading guilty to all charges, this would mean that they not only bypassed the trial completely, but also the jury, and Leopold and Loeb's fates would be decided solely by the judge. So it's kind of like you have to convince one person, not 12, so it's easier to do that. Not only this, Darrow pulled the rug out from under Crow by keeping this plan secret from literally everyone, even his clients. Because he realized Leopold and Loeb were being tried for first-degree murder and kidnapping, both of which on their own could lead to death sentences. So if word had gone back to Crow of what Darrow was planning, then Crow could have actually chosen to only charge the men with one of the two crimes and then a completely separate trial for the other crime, so he would have a two-shot chance to convict them instead of just one. So blindsiding them like this, now he's forced to convict both of them at the same time. So, I mean, it's really shitty, but that is a crazy, honestly ingenious plan on his part.
I tell Mary pass.
I hate to say that, but... So what is often called the trial of the century was in fact an extremely extended and long sentencing hearing, with both sides arguing what they thought the proper sentence and punishment should be. Darrow no longer needed to try and argue insanity. Instead, he only needed to convince the judge of three things. The age of the criminals, because remember, Leopold and Loeb were still only 18 and 19 years old at the time. Their guilty plea, because they pled guilty to it, they confessed to it, so normally back then that would lead to a leaner sentence and more likely life in prison instead of the death penalty. And the fact that the two were very mentally ill, which was different from insanity at the time. So although the two were very much sane, they were obviously mentally unwell and needed treatment, and this was enough Darrow hoped the judge would spare them the death penalty. So Darrow's mental illness argument included the fact that Leopold went to an all-girls school for the first few years of his life, and that stunted his social development with other boys, and Loeb was often abused by his nannies, which caused him severe mental trauma. Now, they weren't in the clear just yet, because Judge Caverly was infamous for being extremely harsh in his courtroom, sentencing every murderer that passed through it to hang. So while Darrow was going to focus on the mental issues of Leopold and Loeb, Crow was going to continue to hammer in all the evidence that proved the cold and brutal murder of Bobby Franks. He called over 80 witnesses to the stand to testify to the brutality and callousness of the crime. So it's kind of still technically like a trial, there's just not a jury, because they still have to call witnesses and experts to try and defend why they think the sentencing should be. So over the course of 7 days, Crow interviewed 80 witnesses from every aspect, ranging from the chauffeur who was working on Leopold's car the day of the murder, to medical experts, to forensic and eyewitnesses who interacted with Leopold and Loeb during various parts of their planning and execution of the murder. And to add an emotional aspect to it, he even had Bobby's parents testify to the kidnapping, receiving of the ransom, and how they felt upon learning that Bobby's body had been found. During all 80 testimonies, Darrow remained silent and declined to cross-examine any of them, fully aware that it would implicate his clients even more, no matter which way he tried to spin it. If he tried to cross-examine them, it was just going to dig their grave even deeper. So by the end of Crow's 7 days of testimony, there was absolutely no shadow of a doubt that Leopold and Loeb were cold-blooded killers who murdered an innocent child for the sole purpose of seeing if they could get away with it. Crow also argued that that's the sole reason that they were there. This wasn't about how mentally unwell they were or how bad their childhoods were. This was about the fact that they planned and executed this horrific murder of a child. Now, in response to these testimonies, Darrow confirmed that he isn't arguing the two did it, because they most certainly did, but both boys suffered from extreme mental and psychological issues from an early age. Darrow had several witnesses come in and testify that Leopold had actually been sexually abused by a nanny when he was a young boy, and Loeb was stunted emotionally, having the emotional capacity of about a 4-year-old. And to drive this point home, Loeb would actually talk to a teddy bear at night and tell them about their day, even when he was in prison, and at trial he would hold the teddy bear with him. On top of this, Darrow introduced something into the courtroom that had never been done up to that point, and was said by Judge Caverly to be so shocking that what was spoken was never to leave that courtroom or be released to the press. Darrow introduced the homosexuality of the two men as reasons and proof that the men suffered from mental illness. The letter from Leopold to Loeb where he threatened to out both of them was entered into evidence, and several witnesses and doctors were called to testify to the sexual relationship between the two, with one doctor who interviewed the boys stating,
"Leopold has for many years a great deal of fantasy life surrounding sex activity. That is part of his whole story and has been for many years. He has fantasies of being with a man and usually with Loeb himself. Even when he has connection with girls, and the whole thing is an absurd situation because there is nothing but just putting his penis between his fellow's legs and getting a sort of thrill. He says that he gets a thrill out of anticipating it. Loeb would pretend to be drunk, then this fellow would undress him, and then he would almost rape him and be furiously passionate at the time, whereas with women, he does not get the same thrill and passion."
So, of course, for 1920s America, the fact that the two actually admitted to being in a homosexual relationship was bad enough. Just the mention of it horrified everyone in the tightly packed courtroom, almost as much as the actual murder. So it should be pointed out first that during the Jazz Age, Roaring Twenties, queer representation and rights actually flourished for a time as part of the current generation's move towards freedom and love following the end of World War I. Hundreds of gay nightclubs began opening up in every major city, and drag shows, drag balls, and gay comedic characters were growing extremely popular with the younger audience, to the point where movies began to feature drag queens or feminine gay men in comedic roles. So this was, of course, before the enforcement of the Hays Code, which prohibited what could be represented on screen. And so for a time, queer representation actually flourished. Chicago was actually home to one of the most active and largest queer scenes in America, having its own gay village known as The Loop at the time. So this was a period that is actually known as the pansy craze of the 1920s, and we're probably going to do an episode on it here soon, but for the time, things seemed to be on the up and up, and I do bring this up for a point because I'll mention towards the end of the episode the effect Leopold and Loeb had on essentially killing off the pansy craze of the 1920s. But of course, to the public at large, the idea of homosexuality was one of the worst taboos that you could not even talk about, especially in high society, and it could still land you into serious trouble if caught in a quote-unquote homosexual act. So it was seen as a mental illness, and anyone stating to be homosexual was seen as a sexual predator, and so Darrow chose to use this to his advantage to show how Leopold and Loeb were not of sound mind, corrupted by their quote-unquote queer fantasies. Crow, however, used this to his advantage too, stating that since Bobby was found nude, it was possible the two men kidnapped Bobby in order to sexually abuse him, and that made the crime all the more heinous and horrific. So during all this, Leopold and Loeb did not say a word during their entire sentencing, and instead sat behind their counsel, snickering and making jokes with each other. Both were seen trying to hold back laughter as Jacob Franks described the condition in which his son was found, and normally a lawyer would probably advise their clients against this, but Darrow let it happen as he believed it only further showed how detached from reality the two were, and how mentally unwell they actually were. Neither expressed any remorse, and Jacob Franks would later comment how he still couldn't believe that they were the ones who killed his son, stating, "I thought I was a pretty good judge of human nature during my long experience, but I find I have encountered an unsolvable problem. It's impossible for me to sit here and believe, as I watch those boys, they are the ones who killed my child. They seem so gentle, they're so refined looking." So on August 19th, closing arguments were presented by Crow and Darrow. Over 3,000 people crammed into the courtroom, and on the front steps outside, eager to hear the verdict. Crow went first for the prosecution, and he kept his statement brief, stating, "If this is not a murder of the extreme type on the facts, then, of course, a lesser penalty than death could be invoked. But when months of planning, careful execution of every detail, a money motive, a kidnapping for ransom, the crucial blows of a sharp steel chisel, the gagging, the death, and the hiding of the body, all appear, as they do here, the malice and deliberation took the crime out of the scale of lesser penalties and prescribed death." Crow went on to again remind Judge Caverly that since the two defendants had admitted to being in a homosexual relationship, he believes they kidnapped Bobby to sexually abuse him, and even boldly stated that Bobby had been raped before his death, even though there was no actual evidence of that happening. But he was like, if this evidence doesn't get them convicted, then the fact that they are gay and did that to a little boy is definitely, without a shadow of a doubt, going to get a death penalty. But then it came time for Darrow's closing statement. And when I tell you it was a closing statement to end all closing statements, I'm not exaggerating. So Darrow started his closing statements at 2:30 p.m., and he talked and pleaded his case for 8 hours. It went on so long that they actually had to continue it the following day to allow him to finish. Now, of course, I'm not going to read you the whole thing, but some of the major points he hit on were, "Your Honor knows that in this very court, crimes of violence have increased growing out of the war, not necessarily by those who fought, but by those that learned that blood was cheap and human life was cheap, and if the state could take it lightly, why not the boy? Has the court any right to consider anything but these two boys? The state says that Your Honor has a right to consider the welfare of the community as you have. If the welfare of the community would be benefited by taking these lives, well and good. I think it would work evil that no one could measure. Has Your Honor a right to consider the families of these defendants? I have been sorry, and I am sorry for the bereavement of Mr. and Mrs. Franks, for those broken ties that cannot be healed. All I can hope and wish is that some good may come from it all. But as compared with the families of Leopold and Loeb, the Franks are to be envied, and everyone knows it." Which is a bold thing to say. "Here is Leopold's father, and this boy was the pride of his life. He watched him, and he cared for him, he worked for him. The boy was brilliant and accomplished. He educated him, and he thought that fame and position awaited him, as it should have awaited. It is a hard thing for a father to see his life's hopes crumble into dust. And Loeb's the same. Here are the faithful uncle and brother who have watched here day by day, while Dickie's father," that's their nickname for Richard, "and his mother are too ill to stand this terrific stain, and shall, by waiting for a message which means more to them than it can mean to you or me, shall they be taken into account in their general bereavement. The easy thing and the popular thing to do is to hang my clients. I know it. Men and women who do not think will applaud. The cruel and thoughtless will approve. It will be easy today, but in Chicago and reaching out over the length and breadth of the land, more and more fathers and mothers, the humane, the kind, and the hopeful, who are gaining an understanding and asking questions not only about these poor boys, but about their own, these will join in no acclaim at the death of my clients." So essentially what he's saying is, like, they were driven to this point after the atrocities of World War I. It was a different climate back then. A lot of people, so many people died during the war that it wouldn't be a surprise that people in the general public would be like, well, obviously life doesn't matter if the government's willing to send all these people to die. And he was like, so how can they argue that Leopold and Loeb don't have that right too, which is weird. And then of course he tried to play up to the whole family aspect, like, don't spare them because they deserve to be spared. Spare them because their families deserve to be spared and they've already suffered enough. And so, kind of problematic there. I don't think you could say that today, but he did for 8 hours.
That's another thing. If you talked for 8 hours, even to a judge, that judge has got to, like, he's got to zone you out at a certain point. So I think it would actually be detrimental to speak that long. I mean, make it short, concise, say your point and everything, but to speak for 8 hours, I'd probably convict them, just make you shut up.
I honestly, if I was a judge, I know you're supposed to let them speak their full piece, but I'd be like, I'm going to stop you right there. About an hour or two at the most in, I'd be like, this is, no, we need to wrap it up. But finally, after 8 hours, Darrow concluded his closing argument and Judge Caverly finally got to go and make his decision. And I'm sure he was like, freaking finally, God. So returning shortly after and addressing the court, Judge Caverly started off his statement by immediately telling both the prosecutor and the defense that none of the mental and psychological aspects of the case that they had been arguing over this entire case would be considered by him in making his decision. He didn't care about the mental state of the boys or if they were quote-unquote sex perverts or even if they were insane, and none of the dozens of fancy doctors and psychiatrists they brought in mattered to him. So he was essentially telling them, like, you boys wasted all this money and time arguing this, and I'm not even considering any of it. He went on to state that he was sentencing both Leopold and Loeb to life in prison. The sole reason they were spared the death penalty was due to their young age, and the judge stated that no one so young had ever been put to death before in the state, and he wasn't about to set a precedent. On top of their life sentences, both boys were also handed 99 years on top of that for the kidnapping charges. So against all odds, even though everything he did didn't really matter, Darrow saved Leopold and Loeb from the death penalty. Now, this verdict, of course, sent shockwaves through the entire city as citizens became outraged over what they saw as a miscarriage of justice, and many believed it was an example of rich people buying their way out of punishment. Both men were initially held at Joliet Prison, which we actually talked about not long ago in our Queer Hauntings episode, before being transferred to Stateville Prison Correctional Facility to serve out their sentences. Both men maintained their friendship in prison, and to the shock and disgust of everyone, they actually seemed to be adjusting well to prison life, and even got jobs working in the prison library before going on to actually start high school programs for inmates who never finished school. So the tenured continued to be supported by their families with money, and that afforded them the best privileges in prison. So that was another aspect too. Even though they were serving life in prison, they got all this special treatment. They could bribe the guards for the best food, for access to areas. They got to stay in a library all the time. So this was more like a reward than punishment, honestly. However, karma was about to catch up to one of them in a very big way. So on January 28th, 1936, Richard Loeb gained access to a private shower room by bribing a guard for their keys. At around noon that day, he was taking a shower alone when he was approached by another inmate named James Day. James was armed with a straight razor and proceeded to stab and slash Loeb with it over 58 times. Loeb actually managed to survive this vicious attack and walked naked and drenched in blood out of the showers and approached a guard, his last words before losing consciousness being, "I'll pull through." So Loeb was rushed into surgery, and Leopold was actually alerted to the incident and was actually brought in to see Loeb. Leopold would later state, "Dick was already on the operating table with an ether mask over his face. Four doctors were working on Dick, two on his throat and two on his body. Dick's throat was cut. A series of four deep gashes had almost severed his head from his body. His trunk, his arms, his legs were one mass of knife cuts. Nowhere on his body could you go 6 inches without encountering a cut. He was breathing through a rubber tube inserted into his windpipe through the gaping hole in his throat." Now, Richard Loeb was pronounced dead at 2:45 p.m. at the age of 30. When questioned later on, James Day stated that Loeb had been making sexual advances towards him and had even attempted to sexually assault him on several previous occasions. He also stated that Loeb had bribed him with money and cigarettes in exchange for sexual favors in the past. James was charged with first-degree murder in relation to Loeb's murder. However, he pleaded not guilty due to temporary insanity, and his defense team used the infamous gay panic defense as their main argument. This being one of the earliest known cases of such a defense being used. And it worked. A jury believed James had been driven mad by the homosexual advances of Loeb, and thus they found him not guilty on all charges. But now, whether this was based on the gay panic defense actually working, or if the jury just saw this as justice for what Loeb did, is never really going to be known. So following Loeb's murder in prison, Leopold fully threw himself into prison work, and he began working as an x-ray tech in the prison hospital, and eventually worked his way up to being a nurse with a specialization in helping psychiatric patients. Due to his sentencing, Leopold could be eligible for parole after just 20 years, and he would get years knocked off for good behavior, and he was fully aware of this, and so Leopold was known for being one of the most well-behaved prisoners in the system. During his time in prison, Leopold actually began working on an autobiography, which would eventually be released in 1958 under the title of Life Plus 99 Years. In the book, Leopold is very open and candid with his involvement with Bobby's murder, however, places the bulk of the blame on Loeb as the mastermind and the one who actually killed Bobby, and that he had manipulated Leopold and seduced him to do his bidding. And that's another thing too, Leopold kept pretty hush, but it wasn't until after Loeb was murdered that he began giving interviews and telling everyone like, yeah, it was Loeb, he did all this, he just seduced me and then made me do whatever he wanted. And the book was actually published and remained on the New York Times bestseller list for 14 weeks, and you can still purchase it on Amazon to this day. The book was actually well received, shockingly, and went a long way in helping the parole board make their decision when Leopold was finally up for it. So after trying for parole in 1956 and 1957, Leopold finally went before a board again, and on March 13, 1958, he was released from prison after spending 33 years behind bars. A massive crowd of reporters gathered outside of the prison as Leopold was led outside by his lawyers and addressed the press on live TV. And I'll actually play a quick clip of it here so you can actually hear what he sounds like.
"A month ago, I begged the members of the parole board for their compassion. They found it in their hearts to grant it. Today, I am enjoying the first moment of the supervised freedom which they restored me. I want now to beg your compassion, yours, your editors, and your publishers. Please make it easier for me by not asking me to break that pledge. I appeal as solemnly as I know how to you and to your editors and to your publishers and to society at large to agree that the only piece of news about me is that I have ceased to be news.
Now, following his release, wanting to avoid unwanted media attention, Leopold actually moved to Puerto Rico the day following his release and enrolled in the University of Puerto Rico, where he would eventually get a master's degree in mathematics, going on to become a renowned researcher and teacher in Puerto Rico. In 1961, he met and married a woman named Trudy Garcia, and the two eventually split their time between Puerto Rico and Chicago, with Leopold returning there in 1963. So he would often visit home to Chicago, go back to visit his family, his old friends, and just reminisce about old times in the city. I'm sure he never brought up the fact that this is also where he planned and executed the cold-blooded murder of a kid.
But everybody knew it.
But everybody else knew it, so it's like, Now, Leopold lived a crime-free and relatively obscure life all the way up until August 29th, 1971, when he passed away in his sleep from a heart attack at the age of 66. With his death, the case of Leopold and Loeb seemed to die with him, or at least so people thought. The case had a staying power and grip over not only the American public, but the pop culture zeitgeist of the world. Remember I mentioned the pansy craze of the 1920s, and how for a time queer people saw a surprising amount of mainstream acceptance and tolerance? This newfound tolerance sadly started to wane as the 1920s went on, in part to the onset of the Great Depression and things worsening in the East leading up to World War II, but mainly because of several high-profile, quote-unquote, homosexual sex crimes that many in the country used as a tool to change the public's growing acceptance of homosexuality. The Leopold and Loeb case being the biggest example, with so many bigots using it to state that all homosexuals are perverts and sadistic killers. Now, following the passing of the Hays Code for films in 1934, many restrictions and guidelines were put into place on what could and couldn't be shown on film. One major thing was that homosexuality could not be specifically mentioned on camera, but a quote-unquote queer-coded character could be present in the film, so long as they were not portrayed in a positive light. This led to many examples from the 1930s all the way to the 1970s of every gay or queer-coded character in a film being presented as a murderer, a thief, or dying a tragic death by the end of the movie. And there are dozens of movies based off this case, and so if you want to see probably the most known one, it's Alfred Hitchcock's Rope. Very good movie, very good thriller, and it's directly taken from this case, whole same premise. So dozens of books and movies have been made over the years about Leopold and Loeb, with the first actually being a movie called Compulsion, released in 1959, and the producers were actually sued and taken to court by Leopold for using his story, and he, of course, lost. So it's like you don't get to, you know, have a monopoly on that story since you are a cold-blooded killer. So in the end, the case of Leopold and Loeb continues to fascinate and enthrall people even 100 years after it occurred, and it sadly remains a benchmark case in queer history, and it had unexpected consequences for queer representation for decades to come that we finally just now seem to be overcoming. And that is the case of Leopold and Loeb, two of the most psychotic people you'll ever hear about.
Douchebags.
And major douchebags. And so, like I said, it's a really fascinating case because it did have such an unintended impact on how queer people were represented in the media, and especially film. And that's one of the most fascinating things about this case is because, you know, it happened 100 years ago, and we're just now getting up to the 90s and the 2000s seeing positive queer representation of characters, because for the longest time, there was a very cliche TV and movie trope called Kill Your Gays, which is every gay character has to have some sort of trauma or something traumatic or horrific happen to them in the story. And so we're just now seeing positive, you know, relationships where, like, you know, one of them doesn't have to die by the end of the movie. And so that's just one thing that this case had an unexpected impact on. But thankfully, they're both dead. And with that, thank you guys so much for tuning in for another episode. Thank you for hanging in with us as we fight off whatever it is we have. We don't have COVID. We already tested, but whatever it is, hopefully we overcome it by next episode. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a 5-star rating or review on iTunes or Spotify. Helps us out, helps other people discover the podcast, and we just love hearing from you guys. And if you want to see photos from this case, you can follow us on Instagram at Beers with Queers Pod, that's P-O-D, or on Facebook at Beers with Queers, a true crime podcast. And until Monday, stay dangerous out there and stay healthy, and hopefully you don't get sick like we do.
I'm going back to bed. See you guys soon.
Bye.